Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
All the way back to 2008. Ruination, the early years.
Okay, so imagine for a second trying to cure a severe, I mean like a days-long bout of digestive distress.
Oh, no.
Yeah, but wait, you cure it with a home remedy consisting of canned pumpkin, plain white rice, brown ground meat, and yogurt.
Oof, just hearing that list of ingredients makes my stomach turn.
Right. But now imagine that you didn't just quietly try this vital concoction in the privacy of your own home.
Please tell me they didn't share it.
Oh, they shared it. You actually broadcast the recipe and a really gruesome biological details leading up to it to thousands of strangers all over the world.
That is just, wow. That is incredibly brave or incredibly foolish.
And you are doing all of this right smack in the middle of the most terrifying global financial meltdown of the modern era.
It sounds completely unhinged. I mean, it sounds like the behavior of someone who has entirely lost their grip on, you know, basic social norms.
Yeah, exactly.
But what's really fascinating here is that this exact scenario is not a piece of surrealist fiction. It's a totally documented historical event.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because today we are opening a very specific, slightly chaotic, and heavily stained time capsule.
Heavily stained is probably the best way to put it.
We are taking a deep dive into a massive stack of source materials. We're talking transcripts, audio logs, biographical notes, and community emails.
And this is all from one specific time period, right?
Yes, all centered around a single month, which is October 2008. And our guide through this totally bizarre landscape is a daily audio broadcaster from the southern U.S.
Okay.
And he is known to his listeners simply as Big Fatty.
Big Fatty. And yeah. We really need to set the stage for you, the listener, regarding what kind of historical artifact we're actually dealing with here.
Yeah, it's pretty unique.
Because usually when we look back at history, especially a period as volatile as the fall of 2008, we rely on grand sweeping narratives.
Like the big headlines.
Right. We look at the front pages of the Wall Street Journal or the official biographies of politicians or, you know, the macroeconomic data, the housing market crash.
Right. It's all very structured. It's clean.
Exactly. It's completely sanitized and curated for mass consumption. We like our history to be visible and neatly categorized.
But this is not that.
Not at all. When you step into the world of early, unstructured internet audio, specifically the raw, unedited, daily logs of a single, highly idiosyncratic individual, that neat categorization is completely shattered.
It really is.
We are looking at a historical landscape that is delightfully murky.
Murky is putting it mildly, honestly. The sources we have document his daily life, his incredibly dense web of inside jokes, and some intensely petty community drama.
Oh, the trauma is legendary.
It is. And of course, dietary habits that honestly defy modern medical science.
On the surface, this material reads almost like a script for an incredibly bizarre hyper-local sitcom.
Yeah, totally.
You have a cast of recurring characters, you've got catchphrases and these ongoing feuds, but if you look closer, it's a remarkably rich case study.
How so?
Well, this is a snapshot of early micro-community media. We were watching a broadcaster form incredibly deep, intense parasocial bonds with a global audience.
Way before we really had a word for that.
Exactly. Long before modern influencer culture.
Right.
Before algorithms dictated what we consumed, and way before the concept of monetization even existed in the way we understand it today.
Let's start with the anatomy of this operation, because the structure itself is just fascinating.
Okay, lay it out for us.
So the show is officially titled Big Fatty Online, though the community affectionately shortens it to the BFO.
The BFO, got it.
Yeah. And according to his own lore, this daily broadcast launched on February 3rd, 2008. But he doesn't just say February 3rd.
Of course not. That would be too simple.
Right. Everything in this universe has a specific code or nickname. He notes that the show started during the halftime of the Super Bowl, which he absolutely refuses to call the Super Bowl.
What does he call it?
He exclusively refers to it as the Booper Soul or the Superb Owl.
Which immediately sets a very specific tone for the listener.
It does.
It's playful, obviously, but it also signals a deliberate detachment from mainstream cultural events.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. He is acknowledging this massive, inescapable cultural touchstone of the Super Bowl, but he is forcing it through his own slightly reverent lexicon.
Like it has to pass his filter first.
Exactly. He is taking something universally understood and making it completely proprietary to his world.
I love that. And he operates his world under an incredibly strict, self-imposed constraint. The weekday show is exactly 20 minutes long.
Wow, 20 minutes on the dot.
No more, no less. Now, the background notes tell us that before this solo venture, he actually co-hosted something called the Little Fatty Cast with a guy named Larry H. Vader.
Okay, Vader. Like Darth Vader.
Well, because of the nickname compulsion, he pronounces Larry's last name as Vedder, like Darth Vader, but with this thick southern drawl.
Vedder, that's hilarious.
But yeah, the BFO is his solo project, and it is a 20-minute daily sprint.
And we really cannot understate how vital that 20-minute constraint is.
Why is that so important?
Well, think about modern media consumption. We are completely desensitized to endless rambling content.
Oh, for sure. Three-hour podcasts are normal now.
Exactly. Three-hour unedited interviews, people live-streaming themselves, sleeping for 8 hours, algorithmic feeds that literally never end.
It's exhausting.
But in 2008, by enforcing a strict 20-minute limit, he forces a very specific pacing.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, even when he is literally just talking about a coupon he found at the grocery store, there's a ticking clock in the background. It creates a sense of daily urgency.
Like he has to get it all out before the buzzer.
Right. He has to get his thoughts out, update the community, and get off the microphone.
It makes every mundane detail feel weirdly important. And the physical world he describes within those 20 minutes is so vivid.
Very vivid.
Yet it's totally enclosed in this personalized mythology. He doesn't just live in a house. He lives in a craftsman-style home that he calls the Villa.
The Villa? Fancy.
And it's located in a North Charleston, South Carolina neighborhood that he has officially dubbed Fat Acres.
Fat Acres. Yeah. Okay, I love the commitment to the bit.
Oh, it goes deeper. We know from later biographical notes in the stack that he eventually drives a 2024 Ford Maverick that he named Earl Grey.
Naturally.
But back in these October 2008 transcripts, he is cruising around what he calls South Kakalaki in a white Ford Explosion.
A Ford Explorer, naturally, playfully rechristened to sound far more dangerous.
Right, a Ford Explosion. And the level of granular detail he provides about this car is amazing.
I can only imagine.
There is a whole segment where he talks about getting it detailed after a massive rainstorm. And he doesn't just say, you know, I got the car washed.
That would be too boring.
He introduces us to Larry, the guy detailing the car, and informs the audience that Larry is a 48-year veteran of the car wash industry.
48 years. That is a very specific resume fact.
Right. He gives us the lifetime employment history of the man wiping down his windshield.
That's incredible.
He also talks about his daily grind at a place he simply calls the coal mine, which is his dramatic nickname for his actual workplace of 40 years.
The coal mine.
Yeah.
Very dramatic.
And he introduces his housekeeper, Hortensia. He refers to his late parents not as mom and dad, but as the Hats.
The Hats.
Yeah, specifically, his father is the Orange Hat and his mother is the Hatterina.
It is a complete masterclass in spontaneous world building.
But wait, I have to push back a little here. Why do this?
What do you mean?
Why create this incredibly dense coded universe? I mean, I understand nicknaming a workplace to protect your privacy online.
Sure, basic OPSEC.
Exactly, but why nickname your late parents? Why nickname your car? Is he just entertaining himself or is there a strategy here?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, it goes far beyond simple privacy.
Okay, tell me more.
Yes, not saying your employer's real name is basic internet safety, but psychologically and socially, this continuous renaming achieves something much more powerful.
Like what?
By nicknaming absolutely everything, he is actively constructing an exclusive in-group vocabulary.
Oh, like a secret handshake?
Precisely. When you, the listener, tune in and immediately understand what it means when Big Fatty drives the Ford Explosion from the Villa to the coal mine, you are no longer just a passive consumer of audio.
You are part of the club.
You are an insider. You have successfully learned a second language.
Oh, I see. It's like learning the lore. It rewards you for paying attention over time.
Exactly. And the people who populate this lore are just as vividly drawn.
Yes, his social circle. He hosts these weekly gatherings at the Villa called Friday at Fatty's.
Sounds like a fun time.
It really does. And the guest list sounds like a roster of characters from a surrealist Southern Gothic play.
Let's hear the roster.
We've got Granny, we've got Durwood. There's someone called the Nip, whose sister naturally is named Flo.
Flo and the Nip, fantastic.
We have Cora Beth, whose real name he casually mentions is actually Bill. And we have young Nicholas.
A very eclectic bunch.
Yeah. And they don't just hang out at his house. They frequent a leather club housed in the Metropolis Entertainment Complex over in Augusta, Georgia, which he has appropriately nicknamed the Horror Hotel.
Which brings up a really interesting dilemma for the medium.
What's that?
By mapping out an entire cinematic universe of local friends, he turns the most mundane daily life into this engaging serial narrative.
Right, because having drinks with Bill and Flo isn't interesting, but having drinks with Cora, Beth, and the Nip at the Horror Hotel is.
Exactly.
But what does this all mean for the casual listener who just happens to drop in?
That's the friction.
Yeah, I'm picturing someone stumbling across this audio file in 2008 for the very first time. They hear a guy talking about the Nip and Cora Beth heading over to the Horror Hotel after a shift at the coal mine.
They would be completely baffled.
Utterly lost. It's like turning on a daily soap opera in season 10, or sitting down at a tabletop role-playing game where everyone else has spent 3 years developing the backstory.
Yeah.
It feels actively hostile to newcomers.
It does create friction, absolutely. The barrier to entry is undeniably high.
So why do it?
Because that high barrier is exactly what makes the community so sticky.
Sticky? How so?
Because the reward for persistence is deep, unshakable inclusion.
Oh, I get it.
If you put in the time to figure out who the Hats are and why Cora Beth is named Bill, you feel a sense of real accomplishment.
You earned your way into the club.
That shared vocabulary acts as a social glue, binding this micro community together in a way that highly polished, easily digestible corporate media simply cannot replicate.
Because corporate media is trying to reach everyone.
Exactly. Corporate media is designed to be understood by everyone instantly. Big Fatty's media is designed to be understood only by the dedicated few.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. The confusion is actually a feature, not a bug.
Precisely.
But here's where it gets really wild. Big Fatty wasn't operating in a vacuum. He wasn't just broadcasting into the void from Fat Acres, hoping people would figure out his coded language.
No, he was part of a whole ecosystem.
He was actively participating in a highly reactive, incredibly combative community of fellow audio creators. And the drama between them is nothing short of spectacular.
It really is the ultimate parasocial soap opera.
Oh, without a doubt. Let's introduce the rival cast. First and foremost, we have the legendary Auntie Vera Charles.
Also known within the lore as the Sea Hag.
Yes, the Sea Hag. She broadcasts her own daily show from Walnut Hills, California.
Quite a distance from South Kakalaki.
Very far. The sources detail this hilarious, deeply petty, ongoing rivalry between Big Fatty and Vera.
Oh, what do they fight about?
Everything. At one point, Big Fatty goes on a rant claiming that Vera is so technologically inept that she actually has to push the start button on her laptop twice just to get the machine to shut down.
Which, if we look at the context of 2008 computing, is a remarkably specific technical insult.
It really is.
It implies she doesn't even understand the basic user interface of Windows XP or Vista.
It is so incredibly specific, and the rivalry is so intense, and their interactions are so bizarre that it breeds actual conspiracy theories within the community.
I love a good podcast conspiracy theory.
A listener named Kim Beaver writes in with a full-blown theory that Big Fatty and Auntie Vera Charles are, in fact, the exact same person.
That is amazing.
She calls it the case of Dr. Fat and Mrs. Hyde.
I absolutely love this. What was her rationale?
Well, she theorized that Big Fatty was suffering from some sort of personality disruption or just creative boredom.
Okay, sure.
And that he had literally manifested this elderly Californian woman just to have someone to argue with on the internet.
It beautifully highlights how surreal and unmoored the early audio space could be.
Yeah, because nobody really knew each other.
Think about it. You only have a disembodied voice. There is no video verification. There are no verified check marks on social media profiles.
Anyone could be anyone.
Exactly. Identity itself becomes completely malleable and subject to paranoid community conspiracy theories.
And Vera isn't the only target of his ire. We absolutely have to talk about Archer.
Ah, Archer.
The transcripts from October 2008 are overwhelmingly dominated by the ongoing torment of Archer.
And why is that?
Because, according to Archer, October is his birthday month.
Oh, boy.
Not just a birthday, an entire 31-day birthday month.
A very bold claim for any adult to make. And Big Fatty, I take it, is having absolutely none of it.
He is having zero of it. He relentlessly mocks this self-proclaimed birthday month day after day.
As he should.
He starts offering incredibly sarcastic, cheap gift suggestions for the audience to send Archer.
Like what?
He suggests they pool their money to buy him a $12 subscription to Vegetarian Times magazine.
Wow.
Or, even better, he suggests they mail him some bananas that were specifically purchased by Archer's 80-year-old mother at the military commissary.
Why the commissary?
Because they are 3 cents cheaper per pound there.
The hyper-specificity of the insults is really his trademark, isn't it?
It totally is. But the absolute peak of this feud, like the moment that made me laugh out loud reading these sources, is when Big Fatty plays actual prank audio on his show.
Oh, this is the SNL thing, right?
Yes. Someone in the community secretly recorded themselves at a taping of Saturday Night Live.
Okay.
The musical guest was the band Coldplay. And right as the band starts their performance, this heckler stands up in the studio audience and repeatedly yells out Archer's website URL at the top of their lungs.
Just completely ruining the broadcast of the
Entirely site. Ruining it.
That is an incredible, almost frightening level of dedication to an internet bit.
It's unhinged.
It requires immense real-world effort to execute a joke meant entirely for a niche internet audio audience.
And it goes way beyond just Archer and Vera. There is this sprawling, interconnected network of other creators who are constantly referencing each other.
Who else was in this network?
Well, you have Miss West, who Big Fatty gleefully reports was giggling about inappropriate touching on her own broadcast, The Live It Up Show. And she is currently planning a massive Southern barbecue tour. You also have Ryan Starr Jones, who officially announces he is going on a diet.
For health reasons?
Not at all. Specifically because Big Fatty called him a, quote, fat ass during breakfast.
The interpersonal dynamics are bleeding directly into their public broadcasts.
Exactly. And watching all of this unfold is this Greek chorus of straight listeners.
The Greek chorus.
Yeah. They self-identify as the straight boyfriends of the show. People like straight Bob tuning in from Australia and Phil from Oregon.
So they don't even have shows.
No, they aren't creators themselves. They just tune in daily to observe the absolute chaos of this community.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, what we are seeing here is an early, utterly brilliant utilization of manufactured drama.
Manufactured?
Yes.
Yeah.
These audio creators are essentially inventing professional wrestling storylines, but adapting them for early internet radio.
Wait, you think this was all manufactured? You think Big Fatty didn't actually hate Auntie Vera Charles?
Oh, I think there was genuine annoyance there, certainly. But they both understood the assignment.
What do you mean?
They knew how to amplify a minor irritation into content. Take the episode 182 crossover mentioned in the source material.
Right, the hijacking.
Exactly. In that incident, both Big Fatty and Andy Vera Charles released episodes where they claimed the other person completely hijacked their respective shows.
So it was a planned crossover event disguised as a hostile takeover.
Exactly. It's brilliant cross-promotion. By feuding with each other, referencing each other's inside jokes, insulting each other's technical skills, and playing audio clips of each other, they are actively cross-pollinating their audiences.
That is super clever.
Think about the mechanics of it. If you are a dedicated listener of Big Fatty, and he spends 10 minutes ranting about Vera's inability to shut down her laptop, you're eventually going to go find Vera's show and listen to it, just to hear her side of the argument.
Here's where it gets really interesting to me. The listeners themselves don't just consume this drama. No, they actively become part of the roast battle. There's a specific list sent in by a listener named British John.
Let's hear it.
He emails Big Fatty his definitive top three worst things to listen to in the entire world.
Okay.
Number three is Archer. Number two is Archer having an orgasm. And number one is Archer complaining about having no money.
It is utterly vicious.
It is brutal. It is essentially a continuous audio roast battle disguised as a friendly neighborhood watch.
That's a great way to phrase it.
They mock each other ruthlessly. They complain about each other's voices constantly. Yet they are obsessively listening to every single minute of each other's content.
They really are.
I just keep thinking, why? If they hate each other so much, why not just turn it off?
Because it operates like a highly dysfunctional, incredibly tight-knit family dynamic.
Mm.
Everyone at the dinner table is insulting everyone else, but absolutely nobody is allowed to actually leave the table.
You're stuck there.
The friction is the point. The conflict provides the narrative momentum that keeps people downloading the files every single day.
Okay, I love the dinner table analogy. And looking at the transcripts, that dinner table was firmly anchored in the grim, terrifying physical and economic reality of October 2008.
Oh, for sure.
Because while all this interpersonal community drama was entirely self-contained and silly, the show itself was heavily, heavily influenced by the historical moment it was being recorded in.
And October 2008 was an incredibly dark historical moment.
Very dark.
This is the absolute zenith of the Great Recession. Lehman Brothers had just collapsed in September. The global financial system was seemingly in free fall.
Yes. Reading these transcripts is like getting hit with a bucket of ice water regarding the global financial crisis.
People were panicking.
At one point, that listener named Atha calls in from New Zealand in an absolute panic because $80 billion has just been wiped off the Australian share market in a single day.
$80 billion.
People in the community are grimly joking about jumping off roofs. The global economy is literally melting down around them.
The anxiety in the source material is completely palpable. But what is truly fascinating is how that massive, abstract, macroeconomic terror is expressed in very specific, localized ways on the broadcast.
That is exactly what struck me. The global banking system is collapsing, but for Big Fatty, the primary overriding economic barometer of the apocalypse isn't the Dow Jones Industrial Average.
No, it rarely is for the average person.
It isn't the housing market, it's the price of gas.
Which makes perfect sense, honestly. Think about how most everyday consumers actually experience a recession.
Right.
Most people don't track the minutia of the stock market daily. But everyone drives past a gas station.
You can't miss those signs.
The numbers on that giant illuminated sign are the most visceral daily reminder of economic health. Wow. It wasn't the Dow Jones, it was the pump.
And he tracks it with the intensity of a Wall Street trader. He does this ecstatic, real-time countdown throughout the entire month of October.
How mad was it?
Well, he reports filling up the Ford explosion and notes that gas has dropped from $2.99 gallon. And he celebrates this like he just won the lottery.
$2.99, wow.
Then, a few days later, he reports it drops to $2.72, then down to $2.34.
A steady decline.
And finally, there is this breathless, dramatic report called in from a listener named Jeremiah.
Oh, Jeremiah.
Jeremiah is sitting in a Walgreens drive-thru somewhere in Mississippi, and he calls the show just to declare that gas has finally broken the 190 mark and is currently sitting at $1.88 per gallon.
The level of specific documentation here is incredible.
It really is.
It transforms this silly, dramatic daily broadcast into a surprisingly accurate historical archive of working-class consumer life in late 2008.
It's like a time capsule.
But the economic anxiety doesn't just manifest in tracking the price of unleaded fuel. It deeply physically impacts his actual life.
Oh, yeah, in a big way.
Most notably in his dietary habits.
Right.
This era of the show features what we can only call a severe hyperfixation on extreme, heavily discounted comfort food.
Severe hyperfixation doesn't even begin to cover it. The culinary details in these transcripts are staggering.
They're alarming.
They read like the menu of a doomed empire. Let's break down his trip to the Sam's Club wholesale warehouse.
Oh, the Sam's Club hall.
He goes in, bypasses all the standard reasonable groceries, and essentially buys three massive items. First, a 10-pound resealable bag of hickory bacon for $22.
10 pounds.
And he spends a significant portion of his 20-minute show excitedly calculating the math for the audience, proving that it only cost him $2.20 a pound.
10 pounds of bacon for a single household. It's staggering.
10 pounds. Second, he buys a massive 10-inch coconut cake.
Okay.
And third, a giant boneless turkey breast. And on top of this wholesale hoarding, he is religiously tracking the weekly coupon circulars for the Publix grocery store.
Finding the deals.
He gets absolutely, genuinely thrilled over scoring free gummy bears and heavily discounted white bread.
It's a fascinating combination of hoarding cheap calories and hunting for micro bargains.
It is.
And we really have to look at the specific recipes the community shares with him, because the listeners are absolutely enabling and amplifying this trend of cheap, hypercaloric comfort.
Oh, they are throwing gasoline on the fire. Our friend Jeremiah, the same guy reporting from the Mississippi Walgreens drive-thru, calls in to describe a holiday party dish that he unironically calls heaven on a silver platter.
Oh, I'm scared. What is it?
The dish is pecan sugared bacon.
I feel like my arteries are hardening just hearing the name. What is the actual recipe?
The recipe is meticulously documented in the transcripts. You take 2 tablespoons of chopped pecans, 2 tablespoons of brown sugar, and exactly 1.5 teaspoons of black pepper.
Okay, sweet and spicy.
You press that mixture onto 12 slices of thick-cut bacon. You bake it at 400 degrees for 22 to 25 minutes.
That sounds intense.
But wait, it gets better. Jeremiah helpfully suggests that to really give it some flair, you should soak the raw bacon in Johnny Walker red whiskey for 3 days beforehand.
3 days? The sheer mechanics of that are baffling.
Why 3 days?
What does soaking raw pork in cheap scotch for 72 hours even accomplish, besides creating a massive biohazard?
I have no idea. But the community eats it up. And then there's the discovery of the hamburger fatty melt.
Ah, this is the one that truly tests the limits of human digestion.
A listener sends this concept to him, and he discusses it with absolute reverence.
Naturally.
I want you, the listener, to try and mentally construct this along with me. Imagine a standard, hearty bacon cheeseburger.
Beef patty, cheese, bacon. Simple.
Now, remove the top bun and replace it with an entire, fully cooked bacon grilled cheese sandwich.
Okay, that's a lot.
Now, remove the bottom bun and replace that with a second, entirely separate bacon grilled cheese sandwich.
My goodness.
So your buns are 2 grilled cheese sandwiches, and the meat inside is a bacon cheeseburger.
It's a culinary Russian nesting doll of saturated fat.
That is exactly what it is. It's fractal grease. And it doesn't stop there.
There's more.
Another listener named Bijorn calls in with a dispatch from the Texas State Fair, acting like a war correspondent reporting on local delicacies.
What did Bijorn find?
Bijorn reports eating chicken fried bacon and a fried grilled cheese sandwich that is served with a side of tomato soup for dipping.
Good grief.
I just want to pause and ask you to imagine the sheer physical toll of this diet. The human body is simply not engineered to process a 10-pound bag of wholesale hickory bacon alongside free gummy bears and fried grilled cheese sandwiches.
It really isn't. But this raises an important question. We shouldn't just laugh it off.
Okay, what is it?
Why this specific diet at this specific time?
I mean, the food tastes good. He's a guy who likes his bacon.
Well, that's the surface level answer, sure.
Yeah.
But if we look at this psychologically, this hyperfixation on extreme, dense comfort food and aggressive bargain hunting serves as a massive coping mechanism.
A coping mechanism for the recession.
Right. Think about the context we just discussed. It's October 2008. The housing market is collapsing. Your retirement accounts are evaporating.
It was terrifying.
You have absolutely zero control over the macroeconomic forces that are shaping your life and threatening your livelihood.
Right. You can't stop Lehman Brothers from going bankrupt.
Exactly. You are powerless against the global economy. But you can control the 10-pound bag of bacon you scored for a steal at Sam's Club.
That makes a weird kind of sense.
You can control the coupons you clip for white bread. The sheer absurd excess of the food, a bacon cheeseburger smashed between 2 bacon grilled cheese sandwiches, is a physical rebellion against the scarcity and terror of the 2008 financial crash.
It's like eating away the fear.
It is an aggressive assertion of abundance, however fleeting, artificial, or physically destructive it might be.
Okay, wait, I see your point about control and scarcity, but aren't we in danger of over-intellectualizing this?
How so?
Couldn't it just be that the guy was incredibly stressed out and just eating his feelings? Are we really giving deep philosophical credit to a hamburger that uses grilled cheese sandwiches as buns?
It can absolutely be both. Eating your feelings is exactly what a coping mechanism is.
Fair point.
Whether he is consciously rebelling against economic scarcity or just seeking a quick dopamine hit from salt and fat, the result is the same.
Everyone was stressed.
The community is collectively finding solace in extreme caloric indulgence because the world outside their digital bubble feels incredibly bleak.
I guess that makes sense. A shared trauma response through bacon. But physically destructive is the operative phrase here.
Oh, undoubtedly.
Because this diet perfectly and inevitably leads to the consequence of that rebellion, the biological rebellion.
It was bound to happen.
Big Fatty's culinary choices directly impact the most notorious, frequently overshared aspect of the entire daily broadcast, which is his health.
And this is where the boundaries of the parasocial relationship are truly severely tested.
Look, we all have that friend who maybe shares a little too much about their digestion after a spicy meal.
Sure, we all know one.
We accept it as a quirk of friendship, but Big Fatty takes it to an Olympic broadcast level scale.
It's honestly shocking.
The show features completely unapologetic scatological humor and terrifyingly specific medical reporting. He openly, casually discusses suffering from, quote, the squirts and diarrhea.
He really doesn't hold back.
Not at all. And he knows exactly what sparked the gastrointestinal event.
Let me guess. the 10 pounds of Sam's Club bacon?
Actually, no. In this specific instance, he blames it on adding a leftover piece of lasagna that he vividly describes as swimming upstream on him.
Swimming upstream. Gross.
And he followed that swimming upstream lasagna with a meal from Outback Steakhouse consisting of prime rib, a baked potato, and a blue cheese chopped salad.
A truly lethal combination of dairy and heavy meats.
It's absolutely lethal.
And how does his audience react to this incredibly intimate confession of digestive failure? Do they recoil? Do they ask him to change the subject?
Not at all. Instead of recoiling, the audience leans in. They become his amateur, incredibly unqualified medical team.
Of course they do.
A listener named Brian, calling in from Danbury, offers a home remedy for the diarrhea. But here is the catch. It's not a human remedy. It's a veterinary remedy. It is literally what Brian feeds his dogs when they have stomach issues.
Ah, you mentioned this at the start of the show, the pumpkin.
Yes. Brian seriously advises Big Fatty to eat a mixture of canned pumpkin, plain white rice, brown ground meat, and yogurt.
I still can't get over that.
To which Big Fatty, showing a rare moment of dietary restraint, rightly points out that combining canned pumpkin, lukewarm meat, and yogurt sounds vile enough to immediately induce vomiting.
Which could solve the problem, I guess.
Yeah, solving the diarrhea problem from the other direction.
It is a level of grotesque intimacy that is just fascinating to analyze.
And he leans into the grotesque. He proudly announces to the audience his discovery of what he calls the ultimate fart soundboard on the internet.
Naturally.
Keep in mind, this is 2008, the era of flash games and basic soundboards. This specific soundboard features over 90 distinct flatulent sounds, all given highly descriptive names.
Over 90.
Over 90. He sits there playing sounds with names like the James Brown Stains, the Cheese Dog, and my personal favorite, the Colon Pal.
Colon Pal.
He plays them on the air. He makes up diarrhea poems. And interspersed with all the scatological noise, he details his mundane medical errands.
What kind of errands?
Getting a seasonal flu shot, but he doesn't just say, I got a flu shot.
No, everything has to be a story.
He turns it into a 20-minute saga. He tells the audience about the clinic nurse's specific advice to use what she called the spaghetti arm technique.
The spaghetti arm technique?
Yeah, she told him to let his arm go completely loose and limp, like a wet noodle of spaghetti, so his muscles wouldn't tense up and he wouldn't feel the needle going in.
That's actually decent advice.
Right, but he reports this back to the audience like it is groundbreaking medical science.
This brings us to a crucial point of analysis regarding early digital media.
Which is?
Why would any broadcaster voluntarily share such unflattering, intimate, and frankly gross details with thousands of strangers?
That is what I keep asking myself. Reading this, it feels like sitting in a doctor's waiting room next to a total stranger who has absolutely zero verbal filter and just desperately wants to tell you about the state of their bowels.
It is a lot to handle.
It is jarring. It violates every rule of polite society.
It is jarring. But it is also a highly effective, deeply calculated bonding technique.
Really?
Calculated.
Yes. By intentionally breaking the ultimate social taboos of politeness and bodily functions, Big Fatty completely strips away any pretension.
I can see that.
Think about traditional media in 2008. Television hosts, radio DJs, news anchors. They are polished. They are perfect. They are distant.
They're untouchable.
They don't get diarrhea. They don't get nervous about flu shot.
They certainly don't play the colon pow sound effect on the evening news.
Exactly. But Big Fatty is telling you about his gastrointestinal distress from Outback Steakhouse and his spaghetti arm at the clinic.
He's making himself human.
He is signaling to the listener, I am exactly like you. I am flawed, my body breaks down, I eat terrible food, and I am hiding absolutely nothing from you.
Wow, that's powerful.
It forges a uniquely resilient bond with the listener because it's based on absolute, unfiltered, sometimes disgusting reality.
It really paints a picture of a guy who is just burning the candle at both ends and letting the audience watch the wax melt.
Great analogy.
There is this one incredible anecdote that perfectly encapsulates his chaotic energy. He tells a story about acting as the head judge, or as he insists on calling it, the tallywhacker.
The tallywhacker.
Yeah, at the Miss Patrick's drag pageant held at a local pub.
Tallymaster, yes.
She is up until 3 a.m. at this pub because there is a dramatic tie for first runner-up that he has to manually calculate.
So he's working late.
So he's up till 3 a.m. drinking shots of liquor, presumably eating the swimming upstream lasagna, and then trying to record a coherent audio dispatch the very next day while actively fighting off the squirts.
That is quite a visual.
His nightlife, his terrible diet, and his physical exhaustion are all woven seamlessly into the daily narrative. He is the protagonist in his own messy, real-time novel.
He is fully embodying the chaotic reality of his own life. But what's really fascinating here is that in between these digestive updates, the drag pageants and the feuds with Andy Vera, Big Fatty actually performs a crucial, almost academic role for his community.
Oh, this is the curation stuff.
He acts as a cultural curator.
Okay, let's unpack this curation, because how a guy recovering from a hamburger fatty melt spends his downtime is vital to understanding the show.
Right.
His media diet is just as eclectic and just as deeply consumed as his real diet. He has this recurring structured segment on the show called Memory Lane Music.
Okay, Memory Lane.
And it is a wild ride through mid-century pop culture.
He's leveraging nostalgia.
Heavily. But not just the hits. He finds the weird, forgotten corners of media.
Like what?
In one episode, he plays the theme from The Flintstones, but he doesn't play the classic cartoon intro we all know.
Which one does he play?
He plays ripped audio from an early black and white television commercial where Fred Flintstone and Barney Rubble are doing a full-on, unironic advertisement for Winston cigarettes.
Oh, wow.
They are just standing there in bedrock, smoking and talking about the smooth filter blend.
Which is a jarring piece of media history to thrust upon an audience in 2008. It completely shatters the childhood innocence associated with those characters.
Exactly. Then he does a deep dive into the 1970s television detective show Columbo.
Ah, classic.
He plays the iconic theme music, discusses Peter Falk's brilliant, unassuming performance, and then hilariously pivots.
Pivots to what?
He wonders aloud on air if his rival, Andy Vera Charles, is actually Lieutenant Columbo in a brilliant disguise.
That's so funny.
Yeah, given her supposed advanced age, her confusing demeanor, and her constant questioning of his motives.
He weaponizes nostalgia to fuel his podcast feuds. That is brilliant integration.
He does. He plays the theme to Charlie's Angels and quizzes his audience on trivia, like who provided the voice of Charlie?
John Forsythe, right?
Yes, which was John Forsythe. And he points out a bizarre directorial choice that Charlie was only ever filmed from the rear view.
Oh, I never thought of that.
He breaks down the early 1960s practical special effects of the Patty Duke show, explaining to his audience how the producers used a child actress as a body double and utilized complex split-screen camera effects so Patty Duke could play identical cousins on screen at the same time.
That's surprisingly educational.
He even pulls up the theme to the short-lived 1972 Paul Lynde show, offering genuine critique that Lynde's unique, campy comedic talents were completely wasted in a straightforward, boring father figure role.
It's media criticism disguised as casual banter. But he isn't just looking backward at the 60s and 70s.
No, he's very in the present, too.
He is also actively curating the present, particularly the incredibly intense historic political landscape of October 2008.
And we have to be very clear here, because reading transcripts from a politically charged era can be tricky.
Very tricky.
The sources show he handles this political discussion with surprising, almost aggressive impartiality.
So he doesn't take sides.
No, he isn't using his platform to push a specific partisan agenda. He's reacting to the sheer spectacle of the looming election as a piece of pop culture.
He's observing the theater of it.
Exactly. For example, he talks about driving in the Ford explosion and seeing a local nun, a woman he describes as having severe osteoporosis, standing on the side of the road waving a flag.
Okay.
And he notes that she's using a heavy manual typewriter to type up letters of support for Barack Obama. It's just an observational slice of life.
That's a very vivid image.
Then he completely pans Sarah Palin's famous, highly anticipated appearance on Saturday Night Live.
The episode where she bobbed her head while Amy Poehler did a rap.
Yes. But he doesn't critique it based on her political policy or her platform. He calls the appearance lame purely based on its entertainment value.
He judges it as bad television.
Conversely, he notes being completely captivated by Obama's unprecedented 30-minute primetime infomercial that aired across multiple networks. He reviews it like a film critic reviewing a documentary.
And his ultimate message to his audience regarding the 2008 election is surprisingly civic-minded, devoid of tribalism.
It is. Regardless of all the political noise, the ads, and the SNL skits, he repeatedly, forcefully tells his listeners to make sure they are registered to vote.
a good public service announcement.
He specifically reminds everyone living in his area, South Kakalaki, about the impending voter registration deadlines. And he explicitly tells the audience that he does not care who they vote for.
That's refreshing.
He says, even if your vote completely cancels out his own personal vote, you just need to get off your asses and get to the polling stations.
It's a fascinating dynamic. Mm-hmm. He's utilizing his platform for civic duty while maintaining his role as an impartial observer of the circus.
Exactly.
And alongside the high-stakes politics, he's tracking low-stakes reality television with the exact same level of intense investment.
Oh, arguably more investment. He's obsessively watching Dancing with the Stars.
Of course he is.
He is tracking the weekly progress of former NSYNC member Lance Bass. And he expresses immense vocal relief when the 82-year-old actress Cloris Leachman is finally eliminated from the competition, arguing she had overstayed her welcome.
He has strong opinions on Cloris Leachman.
Very strong. He's also analyzing the travel competition show The Amazing Race, specifically dedicating airtime to breaking down an episode set in New Zealand.
What happened in New Zealand?
He details the strange challenges, like the contestants having to manually squish kiwi fruit with their bare feet and riding these bizarre wind-powered go-karts called blow-karts down a beach.
Which then, naturally, prompts his international listeners to chime in and validate his media consumption.
Right. The New Zealand episode sparks a direct response from his community. The listener named Atha, who actually lives in New Zealand, calls in.
To talk about the blow carts.
And Atha doesn't just call in to confirm the existence of blow carts. He calls in with the results of a massive linguistic research project he undertook specifically for Big Fatty.
Over a catchphrase, correct?
Yes. Big Fatty frequently uses the quaint southern catchphrase, Dear Gussie, to express surprise or frustration.
Dear Gussie.
Atha, sitting in New Zealand, does deep internet research and calls in to speculate that Dear Gussie is actually a cleaned-up, anti-blasphemy version of saying Sweet Jesus.
That's an interesting theory.
He treats it like a serious academic finding. But then, almost immediately, another listener named Julie calls in to forcefully argue against Atha's theory.
What is Julie's counter theory?
Julie claims that the phrase actually comes from a misremembered lyric of the old children's song, There's a Hole in Your Bucket, Dear Liza. She claims she learned the song as a child as Dear Gussie, and that's where it comes from.
This raises an important question, and it really gets to the heart of what this Daily Show actually is.
Okay, what is it?
Why spend your limited, strict 20 minutes a day talking about an 82-year-old actress dancing or debating the etymology of a random southern catchphrase with a guy in New Zealand? Or describing a nun with a manual typewriter.
Because he has nothing else to talk about.
No, I think it's much more intentional than that. It's because media consumption in this specific micro community functions as a communal campfire.
A campfire.
Yes. You have to remember the context of the internet in 2008. It was highly fragmented. The algorithm wasn't spoon-feeding everyone the same viral video at the exact same moment.
Right, you had to go looking for things.
You had to actively seek out RSS feeds, download MP3s, and visit specific message boards. By talking about Columbo and the Amazing Race, Big Fatty isn't just passively watching TV. He is actively assigning his community homework.
Assigning homework?
Yes. He is curating a shared cultural experience. He is saying, watch this specific SNL skit, think about this specific 1970s sitcom intro, and report back to me.
So they can all be on the same page.
Exactly. So his listeners, whether they are isolated in South Carolina, commuting in California, or sitting at a desk in New Zealand, can all experience the exact same piece of culture together and then debate it through him the very next day.
It is essentially a 2008 low-bandwidth version of a global watch party.
It totally is.
He is the host of the digital living room, passing out the audio equivalent of snacks. But all of this, the intricate world-building of Fat Acres, the intense manufactured feuds with Onivera, the shared trauma of the financial crash mitigated by bacon recipes,
yeah,
the grotesque oversharing about his digestive tract, the communal TV watching, it all builds to a specific, incredibly poignant crescendo at the end of the month.
We are reaching the climax.
All of this daily relationship building culminates in a single emotional unboxing.
It is the exact moment where the virtual, seemingly one-sided parasocial relationship suddenly manifests into something undeniably physical and real in his actual life.
Let's set the scene for the climax of this October 2008 narrative. It's October 29th. Big Fatty is sitting in his office at the coal mine, likely minding his own business.
Just a normal day at work.
A UPS delivery driver walks in, hands him a package, and says, "Sign here." Big Fatty is immediately confused. He tells the audience he hasn't ordered anything for work.
Okay, so a mystery box.
He inspects the package, and there is no return address. It is completely anonymous. The only clue is a simple typed note taped to the box that reads, "From one bacon lover to another."
A direct, undeniable callback to the community's shared culinary fixation. It proves the sender is a deep insider who understands the lore.
Exactly. So he cuts through the packing tape, pulls aside those little plastic airbags they use for shipping, reaches in and pulls out the item. And the audio, he just stops.
Complete silence.
Complete silence. Now remember who we are dealing with. This is a guy who talks for a living. He is loud. He is highly opinionated. He is boisterous.
Very boisterous.
He is a self-described natterer who can easily fill 20 minutes talking about the employment history of the guy washing his car. But when he sees this gift, he is rendered completely, genuinely speechless. The natterer has no words.
Because of the profound implications of what the item actually is and what it represents for his future.
Right. It is a brand new black flip video camera.
A flip camera. Wow.
For those who don't remember the tech landscape of 2008, this was a small, highly popular, highly coveted pocket camcorder that recorded exactly 60 minutes of Ultra Series digital video.
They were the hottest tech item back then.
He is holding this relatively expensive piece of technology sent by a total stranger. He finally manages to catch his breath on the recording.
What does he say?
He tells the audience that this is beyond mere random act of kindness. He elevates it. He calls it a superior random act of kindness.
Superior act.
He is so deeply moved by the gesture that he officially declares the 29th of October random act of kindness to a bacon lover day in the lore of the show.
If we really analyze the profound nature of this exchange, it tells us absolutely everything we need to know about the power of early digital communities.
It really does.
Think about the economic reality we just discussed. It is October 2008. People are terrified.
The market is plunging.
The stock market is plunging. And yet, a listener, known only to him as a fellow bacon lover, takes real hard-earned money during a global recession, buys a piece of technology, and ships it to a man they only know as a disembodied voice through an audio feed.
It's beautiful.
It proves definitively that the parasocial relationship Big Fatty spent months building wasn't just a broadcast. It wasn't just a guy talking to a wall.
No, it was a real community.
It was a tangible two-way street of genuine affection, gratitude, and real-world connection.
But wait, I have to ask. Think about what the arrival of a video camera actually means for this specific creator.
Oh, it changes everything.
Here's a guy who proudly claims on his show to hate computers. He literally mocks Auntie Vera for struggling with her laptop.
Right.
He operates entirely in the safe, invisible medium of audio where he can hide out in the villa, maybe recording in his pajamas without anyone seeing him. Suddenly, an audience member hands him a high-definition camera. Isn't that kind of terrifying for him?
It is absolutely terrifying. But it's also an incredibly exciting evolution for his medium. By sending that camera, the audience is essentially sending a message.
What message?
They are saying, "We love hearing about your world. We love hearing about the hats and the Ford explosion and the horror hotel. But now we want to see it."
They want the visuals.
It represents the precipice of the video-first internet that we all currently live in today. The audio era was ending and the audience was dragging him, willingly or not, into the visual era.
It just makes you marvel at how an anonymous internet gift in 2008 felt entirely pure and wholesome.
It was a different time.
Think about what an unboxing is today. Today, if a creator gets a camera, it's a sponsored brand deal.
Yeah, full of ads.
There's an unboxing video with high production values. There's an affiliate link in the description. There's a discount code. But this was just a listener sending a gift to a host who managed to make them laugh for 20 minutes every single day during a really dark time in history.
It's incredibly sweet.
Imagine how rare, how impossible that kind of pure, unmonetized transaction feels today.
It was a very specific, incredibly fleeting era of the internet. It was before the commercialization of the creator economy standardized every single interaction. It was raw, it was messy, and it was entirely human.
Okay, let's take a deep breath and recap this absolutely wild historical journey.
We've covered a lot of ground.
We have spent this time unpacking just a single month in the life of a single audio broadcaster in 2008. We survived the late night tallying at the Miss Patrick's drag pageant.
Barely.
We navigated the horrors of the squirts and the treacherous swimming upstream lasagna.
I'm still recovering from that.
We marveled at the terrifying structural engineering of the hamburger fatty melt.
Yeah.
We witnessed the fierce, petty, highly orchestrated audio battles with Auntie Vera Charles and the relentless, exhausting mockery of Archer's 31-day birthday month.
Don't forget the Coldplay heckler.
And we ended with the magical, silent arrival of a black flip camera from an anonymous bacon lover.
And what this massive stack of transcripts demonstrates to you, the listener, is that true, lasting human connection in the digital age does not require massive budgets or high production values.
Not at all.
It doesn't require a sleek studio or a marketing team or perfect, lossless audio fidelity.
So what does it require?
It just requires consistency, a willingness to be authentically, sometimes grotesquely vulnerable, and perhaps a shared unifying love of heavily discounted Sam's Club bacon. Big Fatty showed up every single day for 20 minutes, and in doing so, he built an entire universe.
Which leaves us with a fascinating, slightly terrifying final thought for you to mull over today.
Think about the digital footprints that you are leaving behind right now.
Oh, that's a scary thought.
The group chats, the angry tweets, the weird late-night searches. If someone opened an archive of your group text messages, your digital grocery lists, your daily complaints about the price of gas, and your late-night rants about whatever reality TV show you are currently watching.
If they opened that 18 years from now,
what kind of cinematic universe would they discover? What bizarre code words and inside jokes do you use every day that absolutely nobody else on the planet understands?
That is wild to think about.
And more importantly, if your daily life was certainly broadcast to the world as an ongoing soap opera, who would be your Auntie Vera?
A terrifying but absolutely essential question for the digital age. Until next time, stay curious, check your voter registration, and maybe, just maybe, skip the pumpkin and yogurt dog remedy if your stomach is empty.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination the Early Years. Join us again next weekend. We'll see you then.